Hello and welcome. This is Mark Weber. In today's broadcast, I'm going to talk about some of the historical background to the hostility between Iran on the one hand and the United States and Israel on the other, but particularly something of Iran's relations with the United States and Britain, and some of the reason for the hostility and distrust that is an enormous obstacle to be overcome to try to make relations better between Iran and the United States. I'm going to talk in particular about the invasion of Iran in 1941 by British and Soviet forces with America's backing, and the very bad legacy of this invasion of the country, which reverberates to this day, and which is an important obstacle to better understanding between Iran and the West, something that very few in America understand and very few people in the West understand. During the 19th century and much of the early 20th century, the dominant foreign power in Iranian or Persian affairs was Britain. It's important to understand that in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, Britain was at the height of its empire, imperial power. And during this period, the what they called the jewel in the crown of the British Empire was India, in a vast, enormous holding that included not only what is now India, but also Pakistan and Bangladesh. And British rule and control and influence over this region of the world, including Iran, was made all the more important with the discovery of oil in Iran in the early 20th century, and the establishment of what was called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Now, this was the foundation of an enormous petroleum empire that is now called BP. BP includes, in the United States, ARCO, the ARCO stations across the United States where people fill up their gasoline tanks, is a subsidiary of BP. Now, the initials BP used to stand for British Petroleum. But this enormous corporation with worldwide holdings began as the Anglo-Persian Oil Company to exploit the tremendous oil reserves, petroleum reserves of Iran. During the 1920s and 1930s, as the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which was renamed the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in 1935, was growing and expanding its operations in Iran, Iran itself was developing and modernizing under the rule of Reza Khan or Reza Shah Pahlavi, who was the founder of the Pahlavi dynasty. His son, Muhammad Reza Shah, was overthrown in the Islamic Revolution of 1978-1979. But his father was a far more independent-minded leader than was his son. And he did a great deal during the time that he was in rule in Iran until 1941 to centralize the administration, modernize the educational system, and do other things to make Iran a more modern and self-sufficient and independent country. He developed the Iranian railway system, established the first university in Iran, instituted a large-scale campaign to eradicate malaria, and centralized administration, the civil service, and tried to introduce other measures to make Iran more self-sufficient and independent. But this conflicted with British interests, which wanted to maintain its dominant control. So during this period of time, to offset British control in Iran, the Shah sought increasingly to cultivate ties with other countries. And, of course, the most important European country at that time was Germany. And Reza Shah cultivated close relations between Iran and Germany, of course, which at that time was the ruler of Germany, was Adolf Hitler. In 1935, as an expression of the increasingly independent policy and outlook of Iran, Iran asked that the country be referred to by foreigners not as Persia, which it had been traditionally, but as Iran. And this reflected the way Persians or Iranians themselves referred to their country, and also underscored the fact that Iran is not an Arab country, but is a country speaking a language, Farsi, which is an Indo-European language. But the British greatly resented Iran's efforts to chart a more independent foreign policy. And this reached a high point, a climax, in 1941. As the Second World War spread from initially the German attack against Poland in 1939, followed by the British and French declarations of war against Germany in September 1939, the war expanded tremendously, and increasingly it became difficult for all countries to stay on the sidelines of this world conflict. In 1939, Iran, along with, of course, many other countries, including Turkey and Switzerland and Sweden, declared themselves to be neutral in this conflict. But this became difficult because Iran's important oil holdings were increasingly important for Britain, which had no oil reserves of its own, of course, and because Iran was on the middle point between Great Britain on the one hand and the rest of its empire, India and Asia and so forth. By 1939, Iran's number one trading partner was Germany, and relations between Iran and Germany during this time were very cordial and very good. In 1941, the situation became even more acute when Germany launched, along with its allies, Romania, Finland, Hungary, and other countries, the enormous invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941. And this immediately, of course, Britain and the Soviet Union became military allies. Now, as I've emphasized many, many times, during the course of these broadcasts, it's very important to cast aside this notion of World War II as the good war, a conflict between good and evil. It's important to keep in mind that the Allied side in World War II included the number one imperial power of the world at the time, Great Britain, and the number one tyranny of the world at that time, Soviet Russia, which was ruled by Stalin. But those two countries, Britain, British Empire, and the Soviet Union, were allies from June 1941 and were joined, of course, by the United States formally after the Pearl Harbor attack in December of 1941, although unofficially the United States was already an ally of Britain and the Soviet Union during this period, even though legally and formally the United States was still neutral. Well, in August 1941, Britain and the Soviet Union, of course the Soviet Union bordered Iran on the north, the Soviet Union and Britain gave an ultimatum to Reza Shah, the ruler of Iran, that unless he permitted immediately British troops and Soviet troops to operate in the country, in other words, to be a puppet of Britain and the Soviet Union, that there would be consequences for Iran. Well, Reza Shah tried to maintain the neutrality of his country, but Britain and the Soviet Union responded with an invasion of the country on August 25th, 1941, an invasion which had very far-ranging, very profound consequences for the future, and for the future of relations not only with Iran and Britain and the Soviet Union, on the other hand, as well, but also with the United States. When Britain and British and Soviet forces attacked Iran in August 1941, the pretext that was given was that Iran was a puppet of Germany, and that they were going in to rescue the country from German control. This was a lie. It was not true. Iran was an independent country, although it had good relations with Germany during that time. The total number of German citizens living in Iran, including most of them technicians and people involved in business, was no more than 1,000 individuals. The real reason that Britain and the Soviet Union attacked Iran and occupied the country was not the fear that it would fall under German control, but for two reasons. First, to secure British control of the Abadan oil fields and refineries along in the Persian Gulf in the south of the country. And second, to make sure that Iran could serve as a supply route to transfer British and American aid to the Soviet Union through Iran, because it was during this time that the Soviet Union faced its greatest threat ever to its very existence from the military might of Germany and its allies, which were pressing eastwards toward Moscow and Leningrad and so forth. During this period, the number one visual form of news was not television, which barely existed, but the newsreels, weekly newsreels that people in the United States, Britain, France, and Germany viewed at movie theaters. And in Britain, the number one newsreel company was the Gaumont British News. I'm going to play the sound of the British newsreel report on the British occupation of Iran, which gives a flavor of how Britain regarded itself and how British leaders justified the invasion and occupation of Iran.
This is the Gaumont British News, presenting the world to the world. Oil refineries at Abadan, in the land that used to be called Persia. Vital strategic conflict between Iraq and the Soviet Union. One of the richest oil fields in the world. In early August 1941, all but in the grip of Hitler through his famous troop of foreign tourists. Now, by swift action by the British Empire and the Soviet, snatched from the enemy's hands. In late August, tanks of the Empire armies moved into Iran. Troops drawn largely from Indian regiments began the occupation of this land whose ruler, for his own gain, was about to sell his countrymen into Nazi slavery. The occupation was completed quickly, though many still think not quickly enough.
Well, that's how the Gaumont British newsreel presented the invasion and occupation of Iran to people in Britain, claiming that swift action by the British Empire saved the country from Nazi rule. Well, this is absolutely a tissue of lies. There was no danger that the oil was going to fall into German or Nazi hands. Iran was trying to maintain its neutrality, and the claims and presentations given by the British government during that time were completely untrue. As already mentioned, the main goal was to secure Iran as a transportation link between the British and the Americans on the one hand, to aid the Soviet Union, and to secure the refineries and oil fields. Already in 1940, the refineries at Abadan were producing 8 million tons of oil in 1940. Well, during this period of time, as British and Soviet forces were attacking the country, the leader of Iran, Reza Shah, appealed for help to President Franklin Roosevelt in the United States. Now, it's important to understand that the United States, although supposedly neutral and supposedly the defender of freedom and independence around the world, as proclaimed in the so-called Atlantic Charter that Roosevelt and Churchill had very publicly and ostentatiously proclaimed, the U.S. action showed that it was not really acting in a neutral way and didn't take seriously its own pledges of support for independence and neutrality. Reza Shah wrote to President Roosevelt a letter dated August 25th at the time of the invasion, asking for help from President Roosevelt. And he wrote, "On the basis of the declaration which Your Excellency has made several times regarding the necessity of defending principles of international justice and the right of peoples to liberty, I beg Your Excellency to take efficacious and urgent humanitarian steps to put an end to these acts of aggression. This incident brings into war a neutral and pacific country which has had no other care than the safeguarding of tranquility and the reform of the country." Now, that's what Reza Shah wrote to Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt responded with a letter, and his letter is typical of the official view of the United States, which was basically a mendacious, a duplicitous one. And here's what Roosevelt wrote back in his response to the Shah of Iran. He wrote, "Viewing the question in its entirety involves not only the vital questions to which Your Imperial Majesty refers, but other basic considerations arising from Hitler's ambition of world conquest. It is certain that movements of conquest by Germany will continue and will extend beyond Europe to Asia, Africa, and even to the Americas, unless they are stopped by military force. It is equally certain that those countries which desire to maintain their independence must engage in a great common effort if they are not to be engulfed one by one, as has already happened to a large number of countries in Europe. In recognition of these truths, the government and people of the United States of America, as is well known, are not only building up the defenses of this country with all possible speed, but they have also entered upon a very extensive program of material assistance to those countries which are actively engaged in resisting German ambition for world domination." Unquote. Well, the statement and the policy of President Roosevelt, the statement was entirely untrue. It was a lie, basically. The claim that Hitler had ambitions for world conquest and that Germany had an ambition for world domination were utterly untrue. Germany had no ambitions at all towards Iran or towards any of those countries. One proof of that is during the Second World War itself, even in Europe, Germany did not try to take over or impose its will on neutral countries such as Switzerland or Sweden. And in fact, Germany didn't try even to impose its own form of government on countries that were allied to it, including Finland, for example, which remained during the Second World War not only an ally of Germany, but also a parliamentary democratic country. The idea that Germany was trying to take over the world, which was a hallmark of American propaganda during World War II, and of statements by President Roosevelt, was a lie. It was untrue. But more importantly, this is at a time in August 1941 when the United States was supposedly a neutral country. For the United States to be given, as Roosevelt said in his letter to the Shah of Iran, material assistance to those countries which are actively engaged in resisting German ambition for world domination, those are his words, was itself a violation of international law because the United States was, at least formally or legally, a neutral country. And yet, the United States, during this period of time, was giving aid and assistance not only to Britain and the Empire, but also to the Soviet Union. And the plea by the leader of Iran to Roosevelt shows a kind of touching naivete, a touching belief that Roosevelt was sincere when he claimed that the United States was supporting the principles of international law and international justice and the rights of people to liberty. The legacy of the two-faced and duplicitous policy of the United States during this time had far-reaching consequences. The people of Iran overwhelmingly learned in a very forceful way that American claims of support for democracy and justice and law around the world were mere words, that they weren't meant seriously, and that the United States, in fact, was willing to support British imperial ambitions and Soviet ambitions, contrary to its own proclaimed principles. And this was a very important lesson for many people in Iran about the true nature of America's foreign policy. The humiliation of Iran didn't stop with that. Shortly after the occupation of the country by British and Soviet forces, the British insisted that the Shah of Iran renounce his throne and turn over power to his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who was made Shah of Iran and stayed in that office until 1979, and was during this period of time a client, a puppet, essentially, of the United States, first of all of Britain and then of the United States. The subservient role of the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, as a tool of the United States was underscored by two things that happened in 1943 during the height of World War II. For the first time, the American President Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Churchill, and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin met in person. And they met in person, of all places, in Tehran, the capital of Iran, because that was considered a convenient meeting place for these three world leaders. And this meeting took place in Iran, which was, as already mentioned, at that time under occupation of British and Soviet forces. But the humiliation went beyond that. The United States and Britain and the Soviet Union, but particularly the United States, insisted that Iran also declare war against Germany and its allies if it was going to have any role in the New World Order that Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill were proclaiming was going to be the dominant power in the world everywhere following the defeat of the Axis and the triumph of the Allied powers in that conflict. In September 1943, Iran declared war on Germany as a condition for qualifying for membership in the new United Nations organization. But the consequences of the occupation of the country by the Allies during World War II was a disastrous one for the people of Iran. The consequences were large-scale food shortages, food riots, and death and suffering in the country under Allied occupation. Well, we're going to take a break at this point, and I'll resume in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. When we went on break, I was talking about the British-Soviet invasion and occupation of Iran in 1941, which was supported by the United States and carried out in violation of international law and in rejecting by President Roosevelt the pleas by the Iranian leaders for the United States to act in accord with its own stated principles, and something of the long-term legacy of humiliation and of hardship that was the result of the wartime occupation of the country by British and Soviet forces supported by the United States. This Anglo-Soviet occupation of the country had very dire consequences. It not only, as mentioned, violated the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country, but it also led to a long-lasting presence and hegemony of these foreign powers that also brought a slew of other problems, including famine, high prices, there was a devastating inflation, scarcity of the most basic necessities of life, and of course the presence of foreign troops who provided for their needs by taking from the wealth and food of the people of Iran. The British and Soviet forces also took over many facilities, infrastructure, and resources in Iran during that period. Iranians were not allowed to operate their own national railroad, ports, grain depots, and even some roads. Within just 2 months after the invasion of Iran in August of 1941, Iran was grappling with shortages of food and unchecked inflation. Bread and other foods were so scarce in Iranian cities, especially in the capital of Tehran, that people turned to eating grass, eating other things. It was 20% of the population of Iran, according to some sources, lost their lives during this period due to poverty, hunger, and illness. Whether that's exaggerated or not, there was a loss of life, starvation, and great hardship as a result of the occupation of the country. An enduring legacy of the invasion occupation of Iran during World War II was not merely the humiliation, the hardship, and so forth. It was also the strengthening of the grip and hold of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi on the country and his role as a pliant puppet of the United States, first of Britain, and then increasingly of the United States. Because World War II, even though Britain came out on the winning side in World War II, shattered the power and impact and role of Britain in world affairs, and understandably, in the years after World War II, the British Empire began falling apart. In 1947, Britain had to give up India, including Pakistan. It withdrew from Palestine in 1948, and increasingly withdrew all around the world as the British Empire collapsed. In Iran, the role and position of Britain in that country was increasingly taken over by the United States. And this legacy of Iran's humiliating subservience to foreign rule was all the worse because the new country taking over was the United States, and that has had consequences down to this very day. Even if the history of Iran during World War II and during the 1940s and 50s is not well understood or known in the United States, it's still remembered by many people in Iran. In 2009, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made a public statement talking about the suffering of his country during World War II in the aftermath of the Allied invasion of the country in 1941. And Ahmadinejad said that he would stand to the end, that's his words, to get full compensation for the suffering and hardship of his country under British and Soviet rule during the war. He said, "We will seek compensation for World War II damages. I have assigned a team to calculate the costs. I will write a letter to the UN Security General, Ban Ki-moon, asking for Iran to be compensated for the damages. During this period, the Iranian people were subjected to a great deal of pressure, and the country suffered a great deal of damage, but Iran was not paid any compensation." Now, this may seem to many people in the United States or in Britain to be an irrelevant talk by a leader of a country who's trying to just get whatever he can or to bring up an unpleasant chapter of the past. But it's important to remember that much of the outrage over this lies in the fact that the United States insists that other countries, including Switzerland and Hungary and Poland and Germany, pay up until this very day huge amounts of money in compensation or reparations for Jewish suffering during World War II. That the obvious double standard that the United States upholds in playing up Jewish suffering and death during World War II while ignoring the death and suffering of other countries is not merely two-faced and duplicitous. It has consequences around the world for countries and peoples who derive the obvious lesson that America's stated concern for suffering and compensation is a very selective, based on a very selective idea of morality. After the end of World War II, British and Soviet forces eventually withdrew from Iran, but the place, the position that Britain and the Soviet Union had held in Iran was largely filled by the increasing role of the United States through its Shah, through its control over the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Pahlavi. Now, this reached a new climax in the years in 1953. There was a popular support for the premiership of Dr. Mossadegh as Prime Minister of Iran, and the Shah of Iran was compelled for a time to accept Dr. Mossadegh as a Prime Minister of the country. Dr. Mossadegh was extraordinarily popular because he sought to bring about a new era of self-sufficiency and independence for Iran, above all in Iranian takeover of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which I already mentioned later became British Petroleum, this enormous worldwide petroleum corporation. Well, the reforms and programs introduced by Dr. Mossadegh were very popular and led to a crisis in the government that also led to the fleeing of the Shah of Iran in 1953 from the country. There was turmoil in the country, which the United States, in cooperation with Britain, sought to exploit to remove Mossadegh from power and restore the power of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi to the throne of the country. The American CIA, in cooperation with the British, carried out something called Operation Ajax to incite mobs in the streets and to bring down the government in order to restore power to the Shah of Iran, who in fact came back. At the time, the American media and American officials justified all of this by claiming that the communist Tudeh party was a danger in Iran and that the danger existed that communists would take over the country. Well, this is particularly ironic considering that it was the United States, which was the number one ally of the Soviet Union, of the communist regime in Russia during World War II. And the communist Tudeh party in Iran had the influence and role it did in 1953 and used as a pretext for the American overthrow of the Mossadegh government, largely as a result or a consequence of the joint occupation of the country by Britain and the Soviet Union from 1941 to 1946. As a result of support from the American CIA and the British MI6, the Shah returned to the country, and the result was to introduce a period of repression, and Prime Minister Mossadegh was imprisoned and held under house arrest until he later died. One of the consequences of this was to emphasize to just about everyone in Iran and increasingly around the world that the Shah was a puppet of foreign powers. And this was a major reason why his rule was not as secure as it was and why there was popular outrage over his rule as Shah of Iran that culminated in the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79, in which he was forced to flee the country. I want to take a few moments to compare and contrast the occupation and the of Iran in 1941 by the British and the Soviets with American support and aid on the one hand, and the German occupation of Denmark during World War II, which was also a neutral country that was occupied by Germany in 1940 and remained under German occupation until the end of the war in 1945. Now, there are some similarities. It's true that when countries face a existential danger or threat, they will break international law and carry out actions that they wouldn't normally. And that's what Germany did in 1940 when it occupied Denmark and Norway. But this was far more justifiable by any objective standard than was the occupation of Iran by Britain and the Soviet Union in 1941. Just a couple of points. Germany's occupation of Norway and Denmark was carried out not in a vacuum, but because Germany learned, the German leaders learned, that the British, again, the head of the British Navy at that time was Winston Churchill, were themselves planning their own invasion of Norway and the Scandinavian countries to keep Norway from falling under from carrying out trade with Germany. In fact, the German invasion of Norway and Denmark in 1940 was carried out just shortly ahead of a British plan to take over. And the British had already begun mining Norwegian waters, also in violation of international law and in spite of protests by the Norwegian government. Now, when the Germans did invade Norway, the King of Norway left the country and was in Britain during World War II. But the King of Denmark stayed in Denmark. And it's remarkable the extent to which the Germans respected the autonomy of Denmark during World War II. So much so that although all the countries in Europe, for example, had rationing, the rationing in Denmark was actually more generous living standards are actually better than they were in Germany during World War II. One of the remarkable odd things about Europe during World War II is that the only country in Europe where free elections were carried out during the war itself was in Denmark under German occupation. Not even in Britain, which was during the period that Neville Chamberlain and Winston Churchill was the prime minister of the country, were any elections actually held in Britain during that period. In fact, when elections finally were held in 1945, after the end of the war in Europe, the Conservative Party of Winston Churchill was thrown out of office, and Winston Churchill, in a humiliating election defeat, had to leave Downing Street. But in 1943, elections were held in Denmark in an election campaign that was very robust. A lot of parties competed during that campaign, and a very, very high voter turnout in 1943. In fact, the highest voter turnout in the country's history. The result of the elections in Denmark, again, these are carried out under German occupation, was to reaffirm the government that was in power, headed by Scavenius, who was a social democratic party leader. And the elections reaffirmed the in power, the government, which was carrying out a policy of collaboration and cooperation with Germany. And this was respected by the German authorities, so that Danish law and Danish administration continued in place during the German occupation. Now, this changed somewhat in the final year of the war as the situation militarily became more and more desperate for Germany. But Germany had no long-term ambitions to occupy Denmark or to impose its rule on that country. As already mentioned, German relations with other countries in Europe are proof that Germany had no desire or wish to impose its form of government over other European states. Some people who acknowledge that the policy of the German government during World War II toward Denmark was relatively benign will sometimes claim that this was because the Germans had more respect or regard for the Danes because they were Nordic as opposed to other peoples. That's also nonsense. German relations and regard and policy towards other countries had nothing to do with whether the country was Nordic or not Nordic. In 1943, for example, Germany supported Albanian independence, hardly a Nordic country in the Balkans, supported the independence of Albania, which after the end of Italian control of the country was in kind of a political vacuum for a time. But Germany had no ambitions to control or dominate or take over even Albania or Denmark or any of those countries. And the claim by President Roosevelt in his letter to the Shah of Iran in 1941 and in many speeches and in American propaganda that Hitler and his government were bent on taking over the entire world. In fact, in one speech, Roosevelt even claimed that Hitler intended to not only take over the world, but to abolish all the world's religions. It was utter nonsense, complete, absolutely no basis in fact. And it's a remarkable thing, the extent to which the American public accepted these breathtakingly false statements without any real serious objection. The far from being sophisticated or aware or knowledgeable about international affairs, the American public time and time again has been easily manipulated because it is so ignorant and uninformed about international affairs. Perhaps a high point of that was in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack in 2001, in which George W. Bush told the American public that the motive of those who carried out this attack was because the perpetrators hated America's freedom. Well, this is so breathtakingly stupid and false that it's astonishing, really, that millions of Americans accepted this explanation, which might be make people feel good and be self-flattering, but which is a complete nonsense, really. In many of the broadcasts I've made during this series and in other talks, I've stressed over and over the importance of understanding in international affairs, and above all, of understanding the background and the context for relations with other countries. Just as to have good relations with other individuals requires a level, at least, of empathy or of goodwill, so also is this important in international affairs. And to try to create better relations between the United States and Iran or other countries requires an understanding or empathy, but at least understanding of the of what Iranians have gone through and of what other people have gone through. It's important that to understand anybody's situation, to try to put oneself in that same position. If the United States had been invaded by other countries that were claiming that the invasion and occupation was being done for its own good, and then imposed a rule so harsh that it led to starvation and death and suffering, and then ask that everybody simply forget about it later on, is asking more than the United States or any other country, any normal people should be expected to put up with. And so also it is with the United States' relations with Iran. A steady drumbeat of propaganda in the American media vilifying Iran as a so-called axis of evil is extraordinary. It's especially amazing considering that Iran has not attacked any other country for several centuries. It's has a far better record of peaceful relations with its neighbors than does, of course, the United States or Britain or, of course, Israel, the country of the United States and its leaders have pledged over and over to defend, not only as a state, but also as a Jewish ethno-religious state. Good relations with Iran should be possible if it wasn't corrupted by two important factors, a desire to maintain or impose hegemony by the United States on different countries or impose its own idea about how society should be organized, and more pointedly, the U.S. alliance with Israel, which views any country that Israel regards as an enemy of the United States. And unless and until that changes, which requires some sort of empathy or understanding for what other countries, including Iran, have suffered and undergone, stalemate and this tension between the United States will persist. Well, I appreciate your joining me for this broadcast, and I hope you'll be with me for the next installment of the Mark Weber Report.